Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Beyond Sleep Training Podcast. A podcast dedicated to sharing real tales of how people have managed sleep in their family outside of sleep training culture. Because sleep looks different with a baby in the house, and because every family is different, there is no one-size-fits-all approach to take. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast is being recorded, the Kalkadoon people. I pay my respects to the elders of this nation and the many other nations our guests reside in, from the past, present, and emerging. We honour the rich knowledge, wisdom and practices of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the birthing and nurturing of children and their unique cultural and spiritual relationships to the land, water and seas. Welcome to Season 3 of the Beyond Sleep Training Podcast, and we really hope you enjoy taking in these new tales as much as we have in collecting and bringing them to you. Just to let you all know, we're no longer running a Patreon for the show, but if you're still keen to chip in, we greatly appreciate receiving any donations via our Little Sparklers website. Helps to keep the show accessible by covering our production and transcription costs.
Welcome back to the Beyond Sleep Training Podcast. I'm your host, Carly Grubb, and with me today is Liz Thomas. Liz is someone I've been wanting on the show for quite some time because I admire her Instagram page so very much, and I just knew that I needed to have her on to hear her story. So she runs the It Tastes Like Love campaign, which is based out of Hong Kong, to normalize breastfeeding, which Liz sees as a women's rights campaign, because it really shouldn't be something that people are feeling they need to hide away or justify or even fight for the right to be able to do what our bodies were designed to do when nurturing our babies. Liz is a journalist with over 20 years experience, and she also has three little people. So welcome to the show, Liz.
Hi, Carly. Thanks so much for having me. I'm very excited to be on. I'm a big fan of this page and all the work you do. So I'm really happy to be here.
Brilliant. And I'll be dropping all of the links to It Tastes Like Love into the show notes as well. So if you're looking for a beautiful addition to your Instagram feed, I can highly recommend. And also the website's full of goodies as well. Now, to get us started on the actual episode, Liz, do you mind letting us know who's who in your little crew?
Sure. I have three smalls. There's Alex, who's 7, William, who's just turned 4, and baby Isabel, who is not really a baby anymore, now 14 months. And the house is total chaos, obviously. My husband and I work full time, and as some of you probably know, Hong Kong is on a sort of semi-lockdown still. So there is just so many things going on all at once, but we are getting there. We are surviving at least.
So with a 14-month-old, you would have pretty much done that whole baby stage right through the pandemic then, Liz?
Yeah, she is very much a pandemic baby, a surprise third. But, yeah, she Yeah, she was born sort of at the tail end of 2020, a little bit early. And we have navigated the very strange times of COVID with her. But she is still super social. So I am pleased about that, because I know that for some kids, it's been sort of, you know, locked down and hidden away kind of thing. So, yeah, she's still a very lively child and happy to sort of chat to strangers and wander around.
Wonderful. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing a bit more about how things panned out with that third baby. But before we get to that part of your story, can we just rewind you right back to before you had that first baby? How did you think you were going to handle sleep with your family?
Well, you know, I came to motherhood a little bit later than most, maybe. So most of my friends had their kids sort of 3 or 4 years earlier, or started their families 3 or 4 years earlier. And they were all sort of, you know, schedules, sleep training, this is how we do it. So I just assumed that there was no other way, that was just, you know, particularly if you have to go back to work. And I don't know if your listeners know, but in Hong Kong, maternity leave when I had my first was set at 10 weeks, which is just 8 weeks. You know, you have to take 2 before you have your baby and then 8 weeks after, which is very, very short. So I just assumed that was what everybody had to do, you know, to manage everything. It didn't occur to me that there were sort of other ways of handling things. And it came as a bit of a shock after, when I realized that actually I didn't really want to sleep train, and I didn't have many resources to look to find an alternative.
Particularly, so you said your oldest guy, he's 7. So 7 years ago, trying to navigate that time would have been really tricky, because that definitely predates any of our work. And I know when I had my 8-year-old, that was right around the time when I was feeling really lost. There was voices out there, but there just wasn't a space to kind of pull it all together. That's how I feel anyway. When it came along, how did it actually go for you then? How did you find your feet?
Well, Alex was premature, and it was a real shock. He came very fast. He came exactly how it happens in the movies, where my waters broke and he was out within, you know, a few hours, and we just about made it to the hospital. So we were separated early on because he was premature. He had to go into the special care unit. I needed emergency surgery. So we had a very difficult and sort of heartbreaking start, because, you know, I couldn't be with him. I had to sort of wheel myself up to the special care unit, handle the issues around trying to sort of express milk to get sort of syringes of milk into him because he was so tiny. And then we brought him home, and he was still, you know, supposed to be in my tummy. I think when we brought him home, he was still 37 weeks gestation, or 36. So, you know, he's still sort of in my tummy. And I had sort of fairly unhelpful neighbors or people I know sort of saying, oh, well, you know, you've got to get him into a routine. And I was thinking, he literally should be in my womb. Like, why do I have to get him in a routine?
He'll be all bundled up and warm and snugged.
Right. And then some family came to visit, and a few weeks later, I think still a week before my due date, and I was sort of carrying him around, sort of doing the kangaroo care, you know, I'd sort of fallen in love with baby wearing, because he was so tiny and he needed to be upright a lot because of reflux. And again, someone said to me, oh, you know, you're going to really spoil this baby. And I kept thinking, this baby should be in my womb. Like, how can I be spoiling him by carrying him? He literally isn't ready to be out in the world yet. And that sort of started the kind of thinking that, hang on, this sort of idea that babies get spoilt, that they shouldn't be carried around too much, that you have to sort of teach them their independence at this tiny, tiny age, when they've just spent sort of, you know, for me, 7.5 months, but for most people, 9 months, having every need met, to suddenly now they're out, kind of go, well, you know, got to crack on by yourself. I sort of found it really alien. And as you say, at that time, there really wasn't that much around, or at least it wasn't so accessible as it is now. You know, obviously, if I'd seen your work at that time, I would have felt much less alone, much less like I was paddling against the current, because I really felt sort of almost innately that I did not want to let him cry. I did not want, if he needed to be carried, I wanted to pick him up. And, you know, it isn't easy because obviously you're often on your own. You know, my partner had 3 days paternity leave and it isn't easy to do it. But I just I felt very strongly that, like, I didn't want to ignore his cries or teach him something. I wanted him to know that I was there if he needed me. And that may have been a little bit to do with how he was born and our separation, but it felt very innate to me. I felt it very strongly inside. And I didn't know who else to discuss it with, because most people were sort of like, yeah, no routine now. You've got to get him ready because you're back at work soon. It's going to be a nightmare. And I'm not saying it was easy, but I just never heard anyone say, you know what, hold your baby and carry him. You know, it's fine. And I would have loved to have heard it, to be honest.
It's amazing how strong that pull was inside you, though, and that you were very in tune with that messaging coming from within, even though you had all of this noise around you, because I imagine, especially being a first-time parent, it would have been quite having the conflicting noise and knowing that you needed to go back to work. What did you actually do to make that marry up, I guess?
I had an excellent lactation consultant, and I do feel very privileged to have been able, my children were born in the public system in health in Hong Kong. So it was a very inexpensive birth, and I put any money that we had saved towards having a lactation consultant come to the house to help me, because in part because we were syringe feeding at the beginning and it was not very easy. I was sort of pumping and, you know, I don't remember sleeping hardly at all. But I found her very sort of, I mean, she didn't say just hold your baby, but she did say, you know, we have a sleep trainer. You can have her come and talk to you about how you want to do this. And I, around the time I had to go back to work, she did come in and she did say, which I'm very grateful for. She said, you know, this baby is very tiny. I don't think that I wouldn't recommend any kind of sleep training until much older, you know, 4 or 5 months, I guess, is when people who follow that philosophy feel that they can do it. But I said to her, I remember saying to her, is there a way of sleep training without him crying? And she was very honest. She said, no, I mean, the thing that we're doing is not necessarily, you know, how we've evolved to, I mean, how babies have evolved to be. It's just that our social lives, our working lives, are the way that we have no major support around us, that has evolved differently to the way that babies have evolved to need us. You know, our sort of evolutionary biology puts us and baby together, but the sort of modern world with, you know, working parents, no extended family around, very little help for very tired parents means that, you know, sometimes that's the choice you have to make. And for me, when she said that, I sort of knew that I had to find another way. And my solution in the end was co-sleeping, you know, to sort of manage the sleep whilst working full time. And again, I must stress it wasn't an easy ride. I was exhausted a lot, but for me, I felt that I couldn't justify it. I couldn't justify knowing that actually the baby didn't need to be trained. It was just that our lives, the demands of my lives were different. I felt that I didn't want to. I wanted to find a solution that would allow him to still have his needs met and sort of juggle along with what we needed to do with our lives.
I actually really like the way that the lactation consultant frankly describe that for you, because it does actually place the issue in the reality, if that makes sense, because you can see why sleep training has become so popular when you place it into that lens. But it also didn't then minimize the fact that babies still actually do, from an evolutionary perspective and a human perspective, grow depending on that contact with their mother. So it was kind of, I guess I appreciate that honesty. I can see why that would still head some people down the sleep training path, but I can imagine for someone like you, it also opens you up to then looking for other options that might perhaps be a different way to approach that problem.
Yeah.
So that's pretty,
yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if the lady that came to my house, she had worked in a sleep clinic, so she, I think she was very upfront, and I don't know if necessarily because she could see my reluctance, she just wanted to sort of lay all the cards on the table. And I did specifically ask, is there a way to do this without him crying? And I guess you have to sort of answer no. The reality is that to sleep train, some kind of upset has to happen, and yeah. I'm grateful for the honesty because it did sort of make it clearer for me. But I did, you know, it was a tiring time. I'm not going to pretend that, you know, it was easy. There were times when I guess I just thought, oh my goodness, how am I going to do this? But yeah, and I felt at my very core that I needed him to know that I would respond to his needs day or night.
And I think that's actually just the reality of parenting a small baby, whether you're working full time on top of that caring duties, it is an exhausting time and it can be extremely challenging and hard. But that doesn't mean that it's not valuable or worth your while in the long run for you and your baby. So I love that you kind of came up with your own solution for that. And you're also honest that it was a real struggle because we do have a lot of families who are navigating that return to paid work outside of the home, and they do find actually co-sleeping is the one way that they can actually get the most sleep for everybody in their family, and it gives them that time for reconnection with their baby. And it's also great for your milk supply if you are a breastfeeding parent. Did you find that helped you, Liz?
Absolutely. I'm going to be upfront. My pumping output has always been terrible and I would always look at the milk and think, I can't believe I spent half an hour trying to get this out. So one of the great things about co-sleeping, and I sort of meticulously follow the Safe Sleep 7 to sort of make sure that we're doing it the right way, was that the baby could reverse cycle at night. So if Alex or, you know, with my other two, they didn't get the milk they needed in the day, they were able to make up for it in the nighttime, just basically because they slept next to me. I sleep with my boobs out, and they get what they need. So I it sort of helped me feel a bit more confident about the fact that over 24 hours they were getting the milk that they needed, even if my actual milk supply, you know, from the pump was not wonderful.
Absolutely. And because some people, like you say, don't actually respond well to pumps, and that isn't always indicative of the actual supply that you have for when baby is actually at the breast. So it's, yeah. It can be a great tool. If you are someone who doesn't respond to the pump, then keeping baby nice and close at night and frequent night nursing can be the thing that actually keeps your breastfeeding relationship going right through those periods of separation.
Sorry, I never had, you know, like their weight gain was always strong when we did the checks and stuff. So I knew that dynamic was working. And also I would say that both my boys were bottle refusers. So they had to be sort of cup fed, sippy cup fed, you know, like we had to use various different tools to feed them. So again, on top of the poor milk supply, I wasn't always sure that in the day that they were getting, you know, like a measurable amount that I could be sort of going, yes, that's enough that they need. So the nighttime, they sort of recouped anything that was not going in because they were little divas about the bottle.
Well, it also relieves that bit of anxiety and pressure you feel about having to have them take a certain amount of milk during the day if you know that that's balancing out at nighttime. So during the day, what was the care situation? How did you actually navigate that side of things for your babies?
Well, in Hong Kong and parts of Asia, we have a very sort of, I guess, unusual system where you have paid childcare that can live with you or can live near you. And so we had that. We had someone who sort of lived near us who came from the moment I left the house till I got back. And she was also able to bring boys to the newsroom. And I was very, well, as you know, I'm an advocate for breastfeeding. So I was very adamant that, you know, I wasn't going to be sort of pumping in a toilet, and if the boys needed to come in because they were not taking the bottle that day, they were going to come into the newsroom. And you know, we just sort of managed to find a way to keep them sort of like close to me in some ways by being able to come to the office at key points, but also have, you know, a dedicated person looking after them.
And how did you actually navigate sleep, like, you know, the team that you developed with your care person? Were you very clear about how you wanted sleep to be handled while you weren't at home, or did they find their groove in their own way, or how did that look?
I was very honest, even when sort of interviewing carers, that I didn't want to sleep train, that if the kids cried, they were to be picked up. There was no sort of, that was the priority, you know, whatever else was being done. If they needed attention and they were calling or crying for help, then they were picked up. And for nap time, that actually meant sort of patting and rocking. And I admit it wouldn't have been easy for the carers, because the boys and Isabel too were used to feeding to sleep. But, you know, I spent some time also holding and rocking them, so they knew that there was other ways to go to sleep. And we muddled through in the beginning. It's not easy to sort of switch gear from, you know, cozily nursing to sleep to just being rocked. But I was clear really, really from the beginning. So they knew, you know, that was the expectation, that the babies would be held and rocked or patted or read stories to, you know, whatever they needed to help them sort of wind down and go to sleep their way.
Yeah, and that's the thing, isn't it? Babies can be quite flexible and resilient in that way, where they can adapt to new ways of going to sleep when they're with somebody different while still nursing the sleep when they're back with you. Did you find that being able to handle the different ways of going to sleep was ever a big issue, or was it something that just kind of became quite smooth over time?
It wasn't a big issue. I think maybe the biggest challenge was that it was still unusual. I mean, even our lovely carer, she adapted very easily. But, you know, she was surprised when I said, you know, we don't sleep train. There is no letting them cry in the cot. And, you know, she wasn't used to it. But I think the kids themselves adapted relatively quickly. You know, they understood that, you know, mummy puts them to sleep one way, daddy does it another way, but every way they're still, you know, close to someone. There is no sort of, they never felt that they were on their own, I think, and that probably helped in the adjustment. You know, whichever way they were put to sleep, it was usually in someone's arms or on their lap or, you know, held.
Beautiful. And I think that's for people listening along, if you are starting to try and picture how your return to work is going to go. We've got a lot of members in the group who found that having really honest conversations with the potential carers for your child is a great way to figure out how that nurturing can look as you navigate that return. And we do know from many, many, many accounts that even in large childcare centres now, we're seeing a real shift in the fact that many of the carers are more than willing to support your baby in arms, off to sleep, in carriers and various other things, depending on what they're allowed to do in their setting. So feel confident in being able to speak to the carers about what you would like to see being done to help support your baby off to sleep while you're apart. So that's a really important conversation, I think, Liz, especially because your babies, you had to go back to work with very young babies. How did it actually go across, like, how did your sleep journey turn out as your children got older? How did the transition from tiny preemie baby go to where you are now with your 7-year-old, for example?
So I feel that it, obviously for the first sort of year or two, the babies mostly sleep in our room, and then we kind of have a very open policy where if there's a nightmare, if there's anything that bothers them in the night, the door is open. There's never a kind of, you don't come in to see mummy and daddy because it's nighttime. So once we transitioned them to their own beds, so roughly around 2-ish, but, you know, the bedtime process was always still, you know, lots of cuddles, reading, laying next to them until they felt ready to sort of drift off to sleep. And then the doors to our room are open, and so if they needed to sort of run through, they could. If they needed to get into bed, they could. You know, we purposely bought a bigger bed so that there was space for kids to jump in if they needed to. The boys now are 7 and 4, and we still, you know, do bedtime stories and lie next to them for a little bit, talk about the day. And then because they're together, they often sort of drift off to sleep just that, you know, but they're next to each other. So they sort of chat and talk, but they have that sort of social feeling of, you know, that they're, it's not just them on their own, that they're kind of like chat, they fall asleep, they drift off. And if they need us in the night, then they know that they can come running. There's never been any kind of rule that it's nighttime and they stay in their bed or anything. Like if my 7-year-old, or, you know, developmentally it's normal, but at the moment he's having a lot of nightmares around death, dying. And he needs to come, if he needs to come and talk to me at 4 in the morning, I'm going to be tired, but I'm still going to sort of answer those needs, because I believe that just because he's getting older, he still might have, you know, other sleep needs that I need to meet. And one of the things that I sort of feel very, perhaps having 3 children of these ages, it's useful to see, is that I can see that, you know, we have good runs of fantastic sleep where nobody needs me at night for, you know, a few months, a year maybe. And then there's a developmental leap and they need me a bit more for a few months, and then it pans down again. And then, you know, somebody else needs me because they've just transitioned from nursery to reception, you know, like these sort of childhood changes, like they all impact sleep a little bit, but they get better. And I sort of think that it's kind of useful to see the 3 of them and realize that, you know, there's no sort of like, bam, you sort of sleep train and then they'll sleep well forever, because there's a new stage, you know, there's a new stage that needs new parenting skills, and you have to adapt to that, in my view, honestly.
Absolutely. And I think for our listeners, it's a really important perspective, because it takes that pressure off to try and get to this elusive point where your child doesn't need you at night anymore. And it becomes a much more flexible version of how parenting at night looks, because I've certainly found the same. I've got an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old, and it really does go in waves, but I'm getting plenty of sleep. It's quite a different pressure, I guess, that goes on you as you navigate these waves, but it's not a matter of my kids not needing me at night anymore for me to be able to sleep well. I can sleep well and still be there for them and have them know that I will be there for them at night, should they ever need me, just like you've described. Yeah. It's a really valuable part of the relationship, I feel. So I'm just looking at our time. We haven't got that long to go, but can I hear just with your 2 subsequent kids, so you had your first guy, and then when second guy and then third little lady came along, have you noticed really different sleep patterns with them, or have they followed fairly similar paths when it comes to sleep?
Well, the baby number 2 was also another dramatic arrival. I had to deliver him myself in our bathroom, and then I needed emergency surgery, and he also needed special care just because it was a very, very, he was out within sort of 30 minutes of my waters breaking. It was a very sort of emergency situation, and obviously it happened at home, so he needed extra help, and I lost a lot of blood. So we were again thrust into a very difficult beginning. You know, we were not together for the beginning bit. I did, and I think perhaps the sleep patterns for him were trickier because of the difficult start. But I was more confident this time that we would find our way through. And because I had continued to feed my oldest into toddlerhood, I had a very solid milk supply, so I didn't have to syringe feed or anything like that the second time around. And we were able to sort of co-sleep very quickly as soon as he was home, once we'd navigated the sort of very dramatic, traumatic first bit, we were able to sort of settle into a rhythm. And with my third, she was a surprise, but I had the experience of being able to say, look, this is generally what happens in my labours. The babies come early, I lose a lot of blood, I need emergency surgery, we're separated. And then it's sort of a bit of a shit show to get us back to kind of, you know, what I would say is like the kind of solid dyad where we can kind of be together and in each other's arms. It, I don't necessarily get that sort of magical golden hour or first few days where you're just with your baby. It's sort of normally lots of incubators and stuff. So with my third, I was able to sort of discuss with the doctors exactly how we were going to manage all of this in order to ensure that I could have skin to skin, the kind of bonding period. And then basically even in the hospital and with the sort of complications that came with my birth, I was still able to co-sleep with her even then. I felt that sort of the knowledge that came from each child meant that the third journey, this last journey, has probably made it the easiest. You know, she has her challenges for sleep. You know, there's teething, there's all of that, but I feel much more sort of like I can deal with anything that comes my way because I was able to say from the start, this is how I want to handle the sleep and breastfeeding situation. So everybody was on board and there wasn't as much separation as perhaps there had been previously because I had been able to advocate for myself and what I wanted from my family. And that both for my mental health and my physical health has made a big difference. And I guess the other thing I wanted to say, I get asked a lot by people, you know, is that the thing about having a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old for sleep is that they are able to articulate their needs to me. You know, they can say, "Mummy, I've had a nightmare. Mummy, I'm thirsty. Mummy, I need the toilet. Mummy, I've wet the bed." Whatever it is, they can tell me what the problem is at nighttime. My 1-year-old, she can't. She can't. She speaks a few words, but she's not able to say exactly what she needs. So the only thing that she can do is cry or fuss. And then I can sort of work out that she might need milk or she might need a cuddle, whatever it is. But, you know, that difference, that seeing it, that they're able to say, "Mummy, this is what I need," sort of underlines to me why it's important for me to respond to the baby's needs. Because, you know, you just won't know what it is that they're after if you don't respond to the crying or the unsettledness. They might be saying, "I'm too cold." They might be saying, I need more milk. I feel scared. I'm lonely." But you have to respond to that. You know, you have to meet that need. And the only way to do so is to hold them or to cuddle them or to pat them, you know, in my view.
I'm absolutely with you. Just because they don't have the words doesn't mean that we don't need to respect and honour those cries. So I'm 100%. And I think that is something that sleep training culture tries to minimise, is the lack of voice that's given to the infant, and the minimising of what those cries could possibly mean is very dehumanising. And like you say, when you can hear from the words of your 4- and 7-year-old what's actually bothering them, that doesn't give extra weight to their experience than to when they were a baby and couldn't say it. So I love what you've said there, and mate, I think it's something our listeners will really appreciate. Now, we're coming up to the 30 minutes for the episode, Liz, and it's been an absolute honour having you on. I'm just wondering if you have a tip that you'd like to share with the listeners that you wish you'd heard right back at the very beginning.
Yeah, I think actually maybe not a tip, but just a thought. I have never once regretted holding my kids. I've never once regretted going to them at night, cuddling them. In the 7 years that I've been a mama, there have been very, very tiring times, but I don't look back and think, "I wish I'd cuddled them less." I absolutely feel that very strongly. There's not one part of me that thinks I should have done this differently. You know, I am so glad, because now at 7, he doesn't need as many cuddles. I can see that, you know, that things are changing already. So yeah, I would say that I don't regret it. There are no regrets in cuddling your children.
And you know what? That is actually a recurring theme in the stories as we're hearing on the Beyond Sleep Training podcast from guest after guest after guest. It's just not something you can ever regret. I feel like the opposite could be true though, where you actually regret not holding your child when they were asking you and showing you that they needed that. So I think it's a really important message to be sending out to our listeners, to know that this is not something you will regret ever in your entire life. So thank you so much, Liz. And it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show and hearing a bit about your journey, particularly for our parents who are starting to look at having to return to work. it can be such a tricky transition, and to know that you can have conversations and options and thinking outside the box to make sure that you and your babes and your whole family unit are able to get through that transition as smoothly as possible. So thanks so much, Liz.
Oh, you're welcome. Very, very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
No worries. And I'll be sure to drop It Tastes Like Love links all through the show notes for our people listening along. And make sure you jump on the Instagram and check out that feed, because it's sensational work that you've got going on there, Liz. So thank you again for being on the show.
See you guys. Thanks.
Thank you. I really hope you enjoyed the podcast today. The information we discussed was just that, information only. It is not specific advice, and if you take any action following something you've heard from our show today, it is important to make sure you get professional advice about your unique situation before you proceed, whether that advice be legal, financial, accounting, medical, or any other advice. Please reach out to me if you do have any questions or if there's a topic you'd really like us to be covering. And if you know somebody who'd really benefit from listening to our podcast, please be sure to pass our name along. Also, check out our free peer support group, the Beyond Sleep Training Project, on Facebook, and all of the goodies on our wonderful website, www.littlesparklers.org. Thanks again for listening today. We really enjoy bringing this podcast to you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.